hey, what are you doing the night of May 1st? Do you have plans? No? You want to come out and do a little something with me? You can tell I haven't asked someone out in a really long time. You don't say, hey, when you want to ask somebody out. There's no grace in that approach. That's the approach of a guy with no game. I'm the gameless guy. Hey, what are you doing? Want to come out and do something special with me? That sounds creepy, but what I'm doing is not creepy at all. You have my word, which, by the way, is what a creepy person says. It won't be creepy. You have my word. Which really means you have my word. It will be creepy. That's the way that works out. But what I'm doing, nothing creepy about it at all. I'm in conversation with the author, by the way, the New York Times bestselling author, Jeff Zentner, about his new book, Colton Gentry's Third Act. Jeff is the author of The Serpent King and In the Wild Light, and when he was a musician, he still is a musician, but when he was a working musician, he recorded with Iggy Pop, Nick Cave, and Debbie Harry. So expect crossover questions from Mr. Zentner. He's a great guy. The Serpent King, when it first came out, we did an In Conversation. This is, God, a couple of years ago. And it was packed then. And now he's super famous, so it's going to be really packed now. So we'll be talking books, we'll be talking music, and I want Jeff to reveal the secret about how to take the perfect author photo. His photo on this book, very handsome. Looking good, Jeff. My author photos, yikes. Not looking so good. In fact, I have not figured out how to take a great author photo, so now I don't even put one on my books. It's true, I don't. There's just a blank square where there should be a picture, and inside the blank square it says, trust us, it's better this way. The event for Jeff will be May 1st at A Great Good Place for Books, 7 p.m. Be there early. I think it's going to be very crowded. Again, May 1st, A Great Good Place for Books in Oakland, California. Speaking of states, my guest today on the program is from Kentucky. That's all I'm going to give you. I'm Alex Green, and this is Stereo Embers, the podcast. Check this out.
You're due for a good thing, baby. Don't let all that extra weight get you down. Open those blue eyes. Take a second. Fresh rain on the mountain. The birds are singing sweet. And I'm convinced the cool breeze came just to kiss my cheek. There's butter on the biscuits. Trees decided it's fall. Can't you hear the front porch siren call? So let me remind you.
Music of my guest today on the program, Abby Hamilton. Let me tell you a little bit about Abby Hamilton. Well, her new album might be called the number one zookeeper of the San Diego Zoo, but Abby Hamilton does not hail from San Diego. The singer-songwriter was born and raised a little over 2,000 miles away in Wilmore, Kentucky. Hamilton's family was a musical one, so much so, in fact, that she has aunts who sang in a southern gospel group called, wait for it, the Hamilton family. But lineage aside, what Abby started to realize when she was in college is that artists like Springsteen, Kristofferson, Raitt, and Isbell have been having musical conversations with each other through their art, and she wanted in on that dialogue of collective consciousness. Well, she's in. Her album is a startling and thoughtful blend of rootsy swagger, blissful Americana, and lyrical smarts. It's one of the most riveting and fully formed debuts in recent memory. And Abby, she's the coolest. Can't wait for you to meet her. Here we go. Me and Abby Hamilton having a chat right here on Stereo Embers, the podcast.
I'm in Kentucky. I'm in Lexington. And it is the gloomiest, rainiest, windiest day today.
Is that weird for right now, Kentucky?
Yeah, well, it's pretty, we have such high humidity, so the springs are like, they swing a lot. It can be pretty rainy, and then all of a sudden it snows, and then it's 70 degrees, so. I love Kentucky so much. It is, I like that I get every season, you know? It's nice. The summers are pretty brutal, though.
Can you hear Kentucky in the music that you're playing, or do you feel... Like, can you feel like the, you know, your hometown vibe?
Yeah, totally. I think there's such a rich history, not only just in the music of Kentucky, what comes from here, but in the family systems. Like, most people, whether they want to or not, grow up in church or grow up singing in church or singing with their families. So there's not a like... world where that like songs were always passed down to me, even the songs of like, you know, Prine and the country world there, like that was something that, you know, the older generation prides themselves in being able to share, especially with old time music. So I don't think there's a time that I'm writing that I'm not recalling at least that exchange in some capacity, if that makes sense. Like, but I definitely can feel like the sonic influence of the region. It's very roots based and long form storytelling, lots of narrative work with lyrical storytelling that has massively influenced my writing style for sure.
And us Californians, we go, oh, that's just like the Southern tradition, but it's specifically, yeah. Which I guess it is. But it's also very, but it's also specifically Kentucky as well.
It is. It's very, we tend to talk about Eastern Kentucky family systems as like very tribal, and they're the way you pass down information, the way you even talk. I always joke about like my extended family is all from up there in Pikeville and Virgie. And when anyone's telling you about a person that you don't know, you get about three paragraphs worth of what street they grew up on and how to get there and whose dad, you know what I mean? Like, it's just full context all the time. And I think that's just that language there. It's how you communicate connection. And I definitely have been heavily influenced by that style of communication for sure.
So the storytelling tradition is there's a lot of exposition.
Yeah. I think that's it kind of blows my mind, like, because I came from like, you know, a real love for contemporary rock music in my own exploration as a kid. So like, you know, I remember finding White Stripes and Zeppelin, and then moving into the 80s thing where it was just these massive choruses that were like really big and anthemic. And then when I found Bruce, I was like, this is how this happens together. Like, I get the story, the narrative, the roots, the country, and then these big choruses. And that was probably one of the biggest influences in my storytelling, was how to give a thesis statement around the narrative, you know? And yeah, I've got so much more to learn in that vein, but definitely really inspired by it.
Do you think in terms of central thesis when you're writing?
A lot of the times, yeah. Mm. It's not been deemed in my mind as like a right or wrong way. I'm starting to kind of try to approach different approaches to songs, but it was a really easy, if this makes sense, like a really easy cheat code to get my song across the finish line, was to be like, there's an overarching theme or an overarching purpose to this. And now I'm kind of leaning away from that requirement. Like, once I learned the rule, now I know how to break it. And that's helped me grow a lot. But I definitely, when I'm in the process of writing a song, I lean that way time and time again. I just go, what am I talking about? What is the purpose? What does the character feel? And, if anything, it's a great writing practice. I don't know if it's necessary for every song, but it does help me get the full vision of the story.
If you're writing about a character the way that like Christopherson does or Prine does, is it easier to install a thesis for a character that is not you? And then if you're writing a song which feels like this might be about me, is it harder to put that thesis in?
That's a great question. I think so. I found it easier to, for example, there's a song on the new record called Lucky. It's the opening track. And that song is a character, but she, as I kept writing it, she was a lot like me. So I did find that it was easier for me to find the overarching theme when she wasn't me. I could like give her grace, or I could give her understanding. And it's been harder for me, unless I was writing based on one instinct or one feeling. A song like Mayday, which is also on the record, is totally autobiographical. But I started writing that song on the theme, which was, or on the thesis, which was the hook. If I get stopped at every red light, you know, I'd still be there. And this idea of I could hate you, but I don't, and that's not fair. Like, that was just the whole feeling, the whole thesis. And it was harder to write the verses at that point, you know, but it's definitely easier when it's a character, I think.
It's interesting that you said that you can install grace and understanding to someone that isn't you in a composition. That's so interesting, because you would almost think it'd be the opposite.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's a bigger take on probably my mental health, but I think it is revealing, you know, enough to be like, I can zoom out of this character's life and choices enough to give them context. And sometimes with myself, even when I'm looking in the mirror, I can't, you know, but I hope that changes.
I mean, right. It's like you can give people great advice that you aren't necessarily using yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Totally.
I mean, it's interesting to me because I look at like, so for my own work, my own poems, when I shifted from the first person to the third, everything changed. I was like, oh, there we go. There's the open road I've been looking for 30 years or whatever it was, right? Since I was writing in college. And I was like, now I can write. When I listen to like Springsteen or the Kinks or even a band like the Stereophonics, where it's like, we're going to write about characters, it seems like you can swing the bat a little freer and like...
Totally.
You know, and the connection seems to almost be more direct because of that. And maybe it's because it's not you. So your responsibility list is much shorter.
Yeah. I also think sometimes there to trick your mind. I found this with myself. It helps. That tends to be my mirror. If, you know, I can hide behind a character, maybe I can say what I truly feel, because it's safeguarded by someone else's context, you know? So I have found that to be a little bit true. I like what you said about swinging the bat. There's so much more room to go that when you're not saying I am this and this is the truth I stand on, when it's a character that can just be like, here's an observation of a truth, it helps that message feel less preachy to me, and it can become your chorus. It can become so singable in that way, which is what I've found. Like, so it's kind of a vague thing to talk about now, but it is, I totally understand what you're saying. I have had that a lot in my writing.
It's almost like, you know, Oscar Wilde once said that like, you can tell more about a person by the mask that they choose to wear.
Totally.
Than the person themselves, right? And so even if you're writing about the ice cream man on your street when you were growing up, that kind of becomes you.
Totally. Yep.
So it's always you.
Yeah, I think that's the bigger take there. It is like everything that I'm writing, I am seeping into, you know. So that's a great take.
Yeah, I think it's interesting too, because I always feel like At first, I thought, well, you're so removed. It almost, I think the first person appealed to me when I was a teenager because it felt so immediate and tragic and urgent. And I always thought if you write about a character, then there's too much remove. But it's actually the opposite, I think.
Yeah, I really like the voicing. I feel like that I learned. Isabelle's a great example of this for me. So like when you're talking about a character, or even in the song, the character has dialogue with someone else, he goes back to I. So he'll plop you right in the conversation. And that to me was so, all of a sudden the song was mine as a listener. I was saying those things, even though it was about a character, which I think is just a really, really smart approach to blending that kind of thing. The writing style there is literally going, you know. What was there's a Isabelle song where he does it so well. Said it's none of my business, but it breaks my heart. Drops a bunch of cheap roses in my shopping cart. So like the first line is the thing the lady says to him, and then what she does. And I remember listening to that in high school and being like, oh my God, that's how you do it. That's exactly how you do it, you know? It's very cool.
It's really cool that you were, and he's really a master. I'd put him up there with anybody, really. It's cool that you were thinking about composition and about approach to composition at such a young age, because that as a teenager, that could kind of go over your head sometimes because you're so the romanticism of the song itself can be intoxicating and distracting enough, but you were breaking it down compositionally, which means you've been really thinking about this process in a really deep way for a really long time.
Yeah, I never really wanted, I never saw myself being a singer or a performer. I didn't realize that you could be a songwriter. I had no idea that was a career path until I was in high school or maybe early college. And that was to reference Kristofferson. It was that I realized in the span of a few months that most of my favorite songs were not written by the people that sang them. And that kind of blew my mind. Especially Sunday Morning Coming Down was the biggest example of that to me. Like I didn't know who Kristofferson was. But I was a diehard Johnny Cash fan because I literally wanted to be a music historian. I wanted to be the person in the country music documentaries that talks about, you know, the Cash family or the Carter family. And down that journey, I just fell in love with the composition of songs, getting to know a lot of his work. Come to find out, a handful of those songs were not written by him. And that just, I mean, I just full-fledged deep dove into, I can't remember ever feeling excited about anything as a teenager. Like, didn't super love school, didn't super love, you know, sports or theater or whatever. And then when I found out that could be a job, I was like, I will do that with my whole life. So, I think growing up in church always kind of helped me understand the basics of contemporary composition. I played piano and sang with my family a lot in church growing up. And so I think innately knew, you know, the 1-4-5-4 chord progressions and what a bridge does and the purpose of a third chorus and kind of the rise and fall of a song. And then I fell head over heels with lyrics, with writing. And I think I just became a nerd about it. I was just a total study. I just listened to everything all the time. And yeah, I'm so amazed that now I get to do all of it, like write songs and sing and perform and have a band. Because there's not been a, I can't imagine doing anything else with my life. But the songwriting is my favorite part.
It's interesting because I was in the same position as you, and I was a huge Patty Griffin fan.
Yeah, me
and
too.
Isn't she? She's incredible. Oh my God. And I got the Living with Ghosts album, and I was like, this is like 1995. And I was like, this is the greatest thing I've ever heard. I mean, it's incredible. Then the next one came out, and I was like, this is the next greatest thing I've ever heard. And then the third one came out, and it was like, and she was just doomed to toil in, like, you know, the year-end best of lists of music critics and having trouble pay their rent. And then Dixie Chicks cover one of her songs, and she's making money hand over fist. Yeah. And I thought, okay, maybe if that's the way in, then that's the way in. That's pretty cool. Because that is a job. Songwriting for other people can yield, if it's the right person, a tremendous windfall. So it's, you know, it's an alternative path, but it's also one, it's an additional path to honing your own craft as well, which is kind of cool.
Yeah. I've always loved collaborating, and some of the first songs I ever wrote were co-writes, because I had two really good friends in college who are now married to each other. One was a like chicken picking electric guitar player from West Virginia. The other, his wife Kelsey, was just dear friend who had a total natural knack and sense for country songwriting. So that was my first songs I ever wrote was with the two of them. And to start in this foundation of collaboration with writing, I think has been such a beautiful full circle journey for me now, as I'm starting to write with artists for their records or for their whatever, just to be the person in the room that says, yeah, or keep doing this, or maybe explore this route, or let me just play the chorus for you over and over so it feels comfortable. And I couldn't imagine doing it any other way. Like, that's my dream, is to also be the writer for the artist in the room, the record deal that just needs to have a story told and needs to have somebody look at them and say, yes, keep going, great idea. You know, that's a dream role for me. So I'm excited to see how that pans out in my career.
And to be fair, also getting back to one last question about writing perspective, just because you're writing from the first person still doesn't mean it's you. I think that's where people get confused with Taylor Swift, is where it's like everyone sort of accuses her of writing songs about herself, but we don't really know that that's true.
Right. I think that's a great take. We have such a funny thing happening in our day and age. I think of the singer, songwriter, the pop star is also the social media influencer. So you feel as though you're getting the entire life story when the record drops. And hearing even just Ariana Grande talk about, she just dropped her record. And she said in an interview, she was like, you want this to be me so bad, and it's not me. She's like, you know, it's that thing. She's saying I from the first perspective, and she's like, it's a song. It's just a song. Kind of hard to do now, I think, but you're exactly right.
It's a magic trick. And I think that it's interesting because people seem to think they've developed an intimate relationship with your life, whether it's your record or Taylor Swift's record, when in fact they don't understand that an I is a character as well. And then it feels like they have knowledge about you, which they really don't actually. They don't have it at all.
Yeah, and people, I've seen artists lean into that so much and be like, you will never know who I am, even though you think you do. And I think that is art as well. I think it's really, really, you could say it's smart, you could say it's dumb, but I think it's calculated. At least, like, people know how to move their story across the line. And I feel like, you know, you never really know who you're getting at times, except for sometimes the Patty Griffins of the world. When I hear that music and see her face, or Sheryl Crow is one of those for me, where I'm just, this is authenticity right in front of me, you know. But even then, I don't know them. I don't know if that story is theirs. And I never will.
Right. Right. And you also don't need to.
Right.
Right. That's the whole thing. I know it's interesting because songwriting is so private, whether it's a character or not. And to take it public
to sort of perform it, to have it played out there in the world, is to sort of take the private, it goes public, and then people can sort of do with it what they want.
Yeah, totally. I have a song from my first EP called Afraid of the Dark that I wrote really about a friend had passed away from an overdose. And the whole song is just about addiction and the friendship strife of that relationship, or your family member, and how you continue to show up. And but I've had many people talk to me that, or say to me that it's made them like hug. I think someone said it's made me held my family tighter, or I thought that song was about this, or I thought that song was about this. And it's so interesting to have your art in the world and it mean so many different things to different people, especially when I thought, even as the writer, I was like, this message is 100% clear. There's no denying what it's about. And to have people like totally interpret it differently is such a wild experience. You're like, it's why they always say that the audience is so much smarter than you think they are. Like, let them eat whatever you send out, you know? And then that song has taken on even more meaning to me over the years, to not just be as simple as this song is about addiction. It has become mostly about family and mostly about friendship and how to hold the ones close to you tight. And that was learned through my audience's interpretation of it, which meant then the song meant more to me in different ways, you know. Right. Really cool.
Yeah, it's like if you go to a museum and you see someone standing in front of a painting for like 10 minutes, right? And then someone else walks by and goes, "Yeah." It's like, you know, both reactions are valid.
Totally. Totally.
You get to do with it what you want. And I think there's that great scene in that documentary on John Lennon where the guy breaks into his compound and says, "Strawberry Fields was about me." And he's like, "Well, it isn't about you, but it's cool that you think it is."
Yeah. Yeah.
You can have it. Do what you want. Do you find that your writing is changing the longer? I mean, obviously, the more you do it, the more reps you get in, it starts to transform. If you look at Springsteen, like those first two albums compared to the sixth or seventh album, it's like, what's happened?
Yeah.
Different person. It deepens. It broadens. Are you finding that as well?
It's been pretty wild. I've like never been in something. Well, especially not a career path, but like even a hobby where I felt like the more I did it, the better I got. And that is true with writing. It has just become like this thing that keeps growing and surprising me. And I'm also just as frustrated or get stuck just as much as I used to, but I've learned tools to put something down or start over or start a new song, as opposed to getting stuck for 3 months in one idea. And I feel, yeah, the voicing of a lot of my writing just totally growing and evolving and changing as time has gone on. And that's been a very, very exciting process. I feel like when I started, I was writing a lot of like really trad country songs because that is what I loved. And that was what was just so easily pouring out of me. And as time has gone on and as I've written more and I've gotten to know myself better, the sound is moving just a lot wider, not as pigeonholed into the traditional country sound that I started in, which I love and adore and will always love. But I'm very excited to see what happens over the next few album cycles and where we go, because it's the first thing I've ever done where I feel like I'm getting better every time I do it. So, but then sometimes you write a really bad song and you're like, I had to just get that out of my system, get that out of the way, and then it's fine.
Sings her songs in airport bars to old men shooting Irish car bombs. She thought she'd have it all figured out. She thought she'd have it all figured out. Takes her tips to the speedway. Pack of smokes and 10 on 8. A handful of scratch offs. And all the rest to the power. She's seen. It's good in bed, good with her feelings. But she knows it'll never work out. Yes, she knows it'll never work out. She's supposed to blame it on daddy. He's only unkind to his mother. That's right, her favorite brother got shot in the army. He said, I guess I just got lucky. Hey, we all just trying to get lucky. Come on and throw me some.
Subject of getting stuck, like if you're stuck on something and you're, say, you're 3 months into being stuck, have you learned or how do you approach it? Like, oh well, if I'm stuck for that long, maybe it's not worth chasing that one, and maybe I never will again. Maybe I'll just put it to the side. It's in the vault, or it's wherever you put stuff like that, or you abandon it. I imagine someone who is early in the craft would keep chasing it, which can be fruitless.
Totally. I'm a little voice memo writer all the time, like just into my phone. So I have everything. I keep everything. There's rarely a time that I throw something out the window unless it's just trash, which is, you know, that happens. But normally that's only if it's one line that means nothing. Mm. But I've gotten better at, instead of like halting my entire process to fix one thing, just shelving it, just putting it aside. And what has happened consistently is that I've not reapproached it to write it in that form. It has come back to me as a second verse for another song, or let me just tear apart this chorus that I tried to work with a week ago. I'm going to take this one line from it and put it in this song. And that has been the most like effective process for my writing that keeps me moving, but it doesn't like totally leave me defeated to know that these things will have a place. And I'll just try to fit them in, like into the board, and just see if this is worth incorporating or if I should just leave it be. And that's been a really, really cool process.
Two really interesting things about writing is that if, let's say it's a late night, maybe there's alcohol involved, maybe there isn't. Maybe it's just a late night and you write something and you're bleary eyed, you got to go to sleep and you go, wait, that's actually really brilliant. And then you wake up in the morning and you go, no, it's not. Right. But then conversely, you could write something where you go, I don't know, and come back to that a few days later and go, whoa, like that's dazzling. Have both those things happened to you?
Yeah, I was about to say both of those things have happened to me.
Yeah, me too.
There was a song that I very similarly late night write that I was like, this is genius. And I remember wanting to send it to my producers who are dear friends of mine. That did Zookeeper with me and we're, you know, getting ready to do record two hopefully soon. But I remember thinking to myself that night, I'm going to send this little voice memo to them and then I'll tap them back in the morning. And then I went back and listened to it. And I was like, oh no, I'm so glad I didn't send that. But then, yeah, also there's a demo that's been floating around right now that I actually really strongly disliked. When I finished it, I was like, this has no place on my record. I do not like the feel of it. And then 2 weeks later, I listened to it in my car and I was like, oh, I really, really like this hook. I really like this song. So it's something where you just kind of like, I found if I get a couple weeks away from the art, I can listen to it again like it's just a song on the radio, instead of being like picking apart every single thing I've done in it. And for some reason it just sounds like a normal song every time, you know. Just requires some time away from it.
I think without the editorial distance, you're not going to know if it's good or bad.
Totally. Yeah. And especially songs you really care about, songs that you know are good, and like lines and poems that became songs for me, that I felt so confidently about, even when they were completely tracked and arranged, you know, if I did not step away from it and completely wash it from my brain for a couple weeks and then come back to it, I would not make a sound, you know, decision.
Right.
That's a great process for editing, I think, is to give yourself time away from what you've made and then come back to it.
This is why I always tell my students, don't write your paper the night before it's due.
Mm-mm.
Right? Like, yeah. I just wouldn't do it. I mean, you'll get it done. Sure, you'll get content on the page, but you won't know if it's good or bad.
Totally.
You know?
I will say though, I've written many a college papers the night before.
I wrote all of mine the night before.
Yeah.
Yep. And they weren't great. But in terms of college, you went and you were studying music history, or what was the major you had declared?
Yeah, it was media communications, and it was this like tiny program they had for contemporary music, was like an emphasis in it. So I went to a tiny liberal arts college in my hometown because I did not want to go to college at all. And my dad was working there at the time. And he was just like, why do you think I work here? So that you can go to college. So I went and I, you know, my big, I guess it wasn't really a middle finger, but I was like, I'm going to do whatever I want to do, which is at the time was contemporary music. So yeah, it's media communications. And then my professor was actually the neighbor across the street that I grew up with. His name's Dr. John Roller, and he was just one of the biggest beautiful influences in my life. wrote a textbook on contemporary music and really was one of the first people in my life that encouraged me to do it how I wanted to, write what I felt and go sit in the practice room and get it all out of my system and come back. And yeah, it was a really, for as much as I did not want to go to college, I had some really beautiful people that came into my life in that time, especially in line with music. So it was pretty cool.
What's the name of the college?
It's called Asbury University. It's like a Wesleyan Methodist college. So there's all, I mean, it's the most classic, you know, chapel four times a week. And there were a lot of rules. So it was not fun a lot of the times, but I made some of the best friends of my life there and were able to trauma bond together to get through college.
I think college is really about the friends that you make.
Totally.
They don't tell you that. They tell you you're going to have four great years and study this, study that. But it really is about those friendships and those connections are so valuable.
Yeah, they're still my friends to this day. It's been one of the coolest parts about touring now, because we've been hitting the road really hard for the last 2 years. And almost every city, mostly East Coast, we've played. I have friends from college that show up, and it's been such a beautiful like reconnection towards the end of my 20s to like re-meet all those friends as we've all gotten older through music, which is so, so cool.
Were your parents supportive of you, you know, sort of becoming a kind of troubadour? The idea of like, I'm going to travel and I'm going to play my music. I'm going to be a songwriter. I'm not going to work in an office or in a, you know, curating music history texts or whatever that looked like. I'm going to get out on the road and play music. Was that something that they got behind and it was, you didn't have to convince them?
Yeah. They've always been so supportive of me. They love music and they love art. I think there's definitely nuances of, you know, the fear of your child being all over the place all the time. I think it can be a lot for, I would imagine, you know, for my mom and my dad, but they have never not supported me or flown across the country to come see us, you know, in Denver or something. And I can't imagine what I would do if my parents were against me in that venture. I know a few people that don't have ideal relationships with their parents because of this lifestyle. And I'm very grateful to have parents that have always supported this endeavor. I don't think they ever thought it would be a career path, but we had a rule in our house growing up that we had to be in a music lesson until we were 18. So my whole life I had to be involved with music, and I hated it. I did not want to be in a practice room. I bounced from piano to violin to guitar, and then finally voice lessons. I was like, I don't have to practice if I take voice lessons. So I switched to that kind of at the end. And then this whole falling in love with songwriting happened really after that. So I think they were just, you know, they have always supported me and bought me a guitar or bought me a violin when I was 12. And I also think they're like probably really afraid just of sustainability. I think anyone would be, but they've never not rescued me when I have like fallen on my face, both financially and mentally and physically. Like they have come to my aid so many times. So I'm really proud to be raised by parents that come outside of themselves to support me. Even if they have opinions, they've never voiced them or projected them onto me, which takes really like emotionally intelligent parenting, you know? So as an adult, right, I can look back and say, I don't know if I would have the capacity for that if I had an opinion, you know?
But even if you majored in international business and you were traveling across the world, they'd worry.
Sure, sure, right. Totally.
So parental worry, I mean, but your brother is there. And so that probably eases, let's say by 50%, it eases the worry.
Definitely.
I don't know what the math is. I'm just guessing, but it seems like that really helps.
It does. It really does, I think, to know that we're together and then to have like, my parents recently just, you know, finally they bought like a 3-acre farm out in the country close to Wilmore, Kentucky. And, you know, so now I have a place to store the van, like the Econoline sits in the barn out there and my merch stores up on the other side of the barn. And so it's like to have them involved in what we're doing and to be able to like house my things there has been such a special process of like them really showing support for me and letting me, you know, occupy their space while I'm out of town has been really special. It's been cool.
I would imagine if it was just you and acoustic guitar in a van by yourself traveling, if I were a parent, I would never sleep again. I'd be so concerned, right? Because like just you're on your own in the world. So having your band, having your brother, I would think that eases that kind of that concern where everyone's sleeping a little bit better than they would.
Definitely.
Right?
And my band is like family to us. Like we've been, the four of us specifically have been together. I mean, really almost since I started this thing, like I want to say probably 5 going on 6 years now. So they are family to my parents as well, you know, and it's been a really beautiful, pretty rare thing to stay together through all of it. You know, it's nice.
How have you done in terms of, because you were saying you weren't a theater kid. You were sort of in that kind of liminal place where you're sort of floating around looking for your thing. Right. And then suddenly there is a theatrical performative element now to what you do. I'm not everyone can be Bob Dylan where you can sort of play the songs and not say a word to anybody and never look at anybody and then walk away and everyone goes, well, that was fantastic. You know, there is something where you got to sell it a little bit where there's social media, there's television, there's chatter between songs, there's smiling when you don't feel like smiling. There's people sort of trying to tap your energy, life force from you. How have you done in terms of transitioning into that element where it's so public in that way? And also, how have you done with suddenly I'm being looked at in a way that I used to just sort of operate in the shadows and now spotlight's on me? How has that been for you? And has that gotten any more comfortable?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say over the years, the empowerment that comes from a crowd standing and watching and clapping and engaging and moving has been one of the coolest energy exchanges of my life, like to be on stage and, you know, in some ways conducting it, but also receiving it. I mean, night after night, we've played every type of, in the last 2 years, we've played every type of show from the dive bar gig in Memphis with 2 people in the audience, the bartender and the door guy, to we got to play Red Rocks this year with Tyler Childers, which was insane. So like the energy exchanges we have bounced between in the last 2 years have been really intense. And the process that has grown the most for me is like edifying my performance to be strong enough to push through maybe either resistance or just no one caring or people screaming or talking over the set, and like trying to create a space on stage that gets me and my band in a place of like leveling up or making a performance night after night a beautiful process for us. A place where we can go on stage and do our job, but also offload stress or look to an audience for support. And I hope that the audience feels that from us. Like we're a place where you can just put everything down and watch what we're doing or forget about your day or whatever it may be. That's the process that's grown really, really quickly for me that has become more comfortable, is like not being so affected by my room, not being so inward, like you said. I think my natural state is to come within inside of myself and, you know, kind of say, well, if you're not listening, I'm just going to do my thing. And there's an element of that too, but I've, some of my favorite performers of all time is that of Bruce Springsteen or like Gwen Stefani, and No Doubt is like these people that take on straight up power stances on stage. That to me, I feel like is the type of performer I will become, less of a skipping and jumping across the stage, but like really a command presence is what I hope to be as a frontman. And, you know, I'm inspired by, yeah, Bruce and Gwen, and then, you know, Brandon Flowers from The Killers. I love how he stands in front of his crowd. And that's the kind of performer I hope to really be, obviously with my own imprint, but that has gotten easier as time has gone on, as I've gotten more comfortable with myself, less whipped by the variables of an audience. Like, I've gotten to know myself better and I've been more comfortable moving on stage or taking off my guitar or holding the mic in my hand as opposed to standing there and strumming. So it's been cool.
Those command performers, like Freddie Mercury, is the most optimum example of like, well, that's how it's done, right? Or Robert Plant. Springsteen's a great example. And I think Gwen Stefani is a fair example as well. I also feel like, getting back to what we talked about at the beginning, those are also, they created characters for, mm-hmm. right? Like, even though it's under Bruce's name, that Bruce Springsteen guy on stage is a character.
Totally.
So the crafting an Abby Hamilton character, a command performance element character, on whatever scale, then when you step off the stage, do you feel yourself turn back into yourself?
Yeah, I definitely. I think I tend to kind of ride that line of introvert to extrovert. The more that I have played shows and been a performer, and then, you know, my hope is to get to the merch booth every time after the set, but that can be hard because all I want to do is just fall over. But yeah, I definitely think that there tends to be a character there for sure. I kind of want to just put my headphones on and play my Switch in the van when we're done. I've had to really muster up that the extension of that energy to be present at the end of the show. And I don't feel that pressure from my band or in the green room ever, but I do, you know, want to be able to walk off the stage and go to the merch booth and meet people who buy my ticket now, because we're just growing. We're just starting. We're really just starting. And I'm for the first time hitting markets that I've supported other bands in and now have come back and headlined, and we've sold tickets and it's worked. And I want to be able to be myself and go to the merch booth and say, thank you. Thank you for being here. You know, you never really know if it works, and it is. So it's been very, very cool.
It's weird because like I've taught college, you know, for almost 30 years, which is like horrifying to say. It's a daunting number, but like me as a professor, that guy is a character. And then if a student walks with me after class, I can feel the character dimming where I'm like, wow, I'm not sure I can keep this up much longer, I think. Yeah. So when Abby Hamilton character gets off the stage and goes to the merch table, because you're no longer in front of an audience, the audience has shrunk. It's just like individual people. Do you feel the character? Can you adjust that character? I don't know why I'm so obsessed with this, Ed, but it's just curious to me. Do you go, oh, I just gotta dim it a little bit, or do you still? How do you do that? And have you figured that? I haven't figured it out yet. As a teacher, I have no idea.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think an example of this, I have bartended over the years in my hometown, and you know, have gotten to tour and, you know, put the record out while having a bar job, and watching how that has been affected to this point of going, it's been really special to be around. I bartended a venue in town, so that has been, you know, totally surrounded by music, listeners, and a tight community of regulars that show up to every show. And to be working and bartending and then have people come up and be so complimentary and, you know, tell me that they've listened to the record or they've been to shows, and having to kind of code switch where, you know, in one second I'm the bartender and then I've got to be myself, but then I've also got to be Abby. So right. Like, right. It sounds like a weird thing to talk about, because it's not that I'm like, you know what I'm saying. It's like, you know, I'm used to just pouring the drink and moving on and starting the tab and here we go. And at pause in the moment, recognize that this person is being encouraging and sees me, and then making the switch in my brain to say, you know, I just have to be myself in this interaction. I don't actually have to be Abby that's going, thank you so much, that's so kind. Thank you. You know, I'm also not the performer in that moment. I'm myself. So I think in some ways that's just a fluidity that I hope gets better over time, is like to walk off the stage or get off of my shift at the bar and be able to be myself to people that I don't totally know. But not for naught, there is things that happen when you start to perform that creates sometimes this energy of isolation, which I think can be false at times, but it's also a way of protecting that energy output that you bottle up and you put on stage. And so then once the adrenaline has come down, when I walk off stage, I have to really make sure that I'm not just dumping at the end of the night. Like,
right.
I have to really regulate to be a normal person, if that makes any sense. This sounds kind of dramatic, but I don't mean it that way. It's just like an energy regulation. It's like, well, you know, we're Fleetwood Mac would talk about, you know, you do your stimulants and then you do your wine and then you do your stimulants and then you, all night is this dance to manage the ride. And as a semi-sober person doing that, it's an intense swing. Like, I would imagine being on a stimulant like that and then drinking would really mess up that kind of, I don't know, it would not work well for me. But I understand how people get into that because of what we're talking about, is like the swing is really intense. And the goal is to be yourself off stage. And I have to push through really hard to not be inside of myself in those moments. That's a long ramble.
No, that's, I think you answered it perfectly. And I think that it's about reading the room,
mm-hmm.
reading the moment, and just being aware of it. Because if you're not aware of it, I imagine those swings back and forth could burn that muscle out.
Totally. Totally. And kind of like numbs you from reality. I think that's why people get a little just swirly whirly up in there, because I get how it happens now, just because the energy is so intense. And I've had shows that were like a really insane, not to keep talking about Red Rocks, but like the most intense energy in terms of volume and lighting and visual. And I felt myself so present. I was there. I was taking it all in. I knew what was happening. But I've had moments where in shows, I wouldn't say similar, but similar in size, where I've been so in my head or so nervous and so stressed that I'm like black out. I don't remember what I'm doing or why I'm there until I get off stage. And I think that's just like nervous system regulation, honestly. Like,
yeah.
That's the higher call of a performer's job, is to really not get thrown by these variables all the time. And I think that's a sign of a really good performer, not necessarily who they are off stage, but their ability to be the character through all of those things. Like, I remember as a kid watching with my nanny was obsessed with the Carol Burnett Show. And so Carol was just a huge, as a kid, I was obsessed with her. I just thought she was the funniest, and we would sit there and we'd laugh and laugh and laugh. The whole sketch where it's Gone with the Wind. She comes down the stairs with the curtain rod on her shoulders. And I remember as a kid being like, that's funny. I want to be funny, like, you know? And I think that there's a resilience in comedic, really just comedians in general, because I don't have an audience that, like, if I sing my song is ever dead silent unless the room is empty, you know? And if they don't like my song, there's still a clap at the end, you know? So I'm not in front of something like that. So it empowers me to be like, be that character and be really good at your job and push through, but people aren't against you. They want to see you succeed. And I think that's a healthy reminder in the nervous system regulation, is that I'm not up here to get like tomatoes thrown at me. I'm up here to perform the extension of myself. And I'm lucky enough to have people care about it and then buy a ticket and then buy a vinyl and then listen in their day-to-day life. And I think that's an empowering feeling to help me push through the insecurity of performance, which can be very hard.
Yeah, it's not like you're at like a baseball game. No one's rooting against you. Like, if they're right. they want you to do well, which is kind of a cool feeling. And I think, so just finishing up, I want to, the last question I wanted to ask you is, you know, that's Deer Tick, right? But that my friend took that photo.
Yeah.
He shot you with Deer Tick a couple of months ago. And I was thinking, like, when you listen to bands like Deer Tick, like whoever it might be, can you listen as a fan, or are you always breaking it down now? Like, oh, wow, how'd they do that? Like, compositionally, you know, almost like a chef who goes to a restaurant and goes, my taste, you know, like they're breaking. I always wonder, can a chef really enjoy a meal out? Do you find that you are listening to music now, not as a fan, but more as a technician?
That's a great question. I would say, yes, more so as a technician a lot. Now, the balance I've done is to not be hypercritical, so that I've been really careful to not be somebody that's like, as soon as I hear a new song, I'm picking it apart immediately. Like, I'm not totally that person, but I will say, listening to so much music all the time, working in a venue and then playing music, it's just my whole life all the time. So like it's impossible for me to not really break it down or begin to develop opinions on what works and what doesn't. I would say the healthiest thing I've done in combating like negative energy in that is just going to shows. I started really just being a live listener before I'm listening to a record, and it's been really healthy for me to like go see the band before I've ever listened to the song. And it's really helped me like composition and like bands a lot more again, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, like, totally.
A practice I did before that Deer Tick show was, they had put out a record right before we went out on tour with them, and I did not listen to it. Sorry, John. But I didn't listen to it because I wanted to hear it live first. And that was one of the best decisions I ever made, because that band is one of the best bands in the world. They are like the quintessential rock and rollers. And to watch them night after night do that record, and now I go back and listen to that record, having experienced it lucky enough like 20 times, it helps me love the records more, simply because of my attachment to them, which I think in turn helps me not be critical. Now, that Deer Tick record is hard to be critical of when
I've got it's pretty perfect
because it's great. It's great.
Yeah.
But even in my hometown, we have such a great music scene here. So I've started just going to a bunch of shows, and I'll just go out and listen to new bands that way before I listen to the records, or I'll buy the vinyl that night or buy the CD that night and go home and listen. And that's helped me be less of a critical listener and more of a fan, more of a supporter, more of a like active participant in what I'm expecting the world to do for me. You know, it's important to do it back.
I love your record. I just think your career, to me, thinking about what's going to come, is so exciting. I think that what you've done for a debut album is just so assured and so out of the box, ready to go. I just love your record so much.
Thank you. That means a lot. Thank you.
And I was looking forward to chatting with you. Thank you for taking the time to talk so much about craft and creative process with me.
Yeah, thank you for asking really insightful questions. And thank you for letting me ramble. I love this. These are the questions I want to talk about all the time. So thank you for a great interview.
Well, there you go. Abby Hamilton, she's the best. She's so lovely and so smart and so interesting and so thoughtful about songwriting and music. I could have talked to her all day. Her new album, The Number One Zookeeper of the San Diego Zoo, is fantastic. I love it so much. You're going to love it too. You don't have it yet? Oh my God, you got to get it. AbbyHamiltonMusic.com is where you need to go to find out how to get it, where she's playing, what's going on with her. That's the place to start. ABBY, by the way, HamiltonMusic.com. AlexGreenBooks.com is where you need to go to find out what's happening with me. My new book, The Adventure Teen All-Stars, is out now in paperback. It'd be a great book to take to the beach. You know why? It's short. It's fast. You'll be done before the sun sets. How's that for a tagline? Don't forget to check out BombshellRadio.com to find out what makes our radio station tick. You can contact me via Twitter, or what's left of it, at Embers Editor, or on Instagram at Embers Podcast, or just email me, editor@StereoEmbersMagazine.com. Stereo Embers, the podcast, is available on all podcast platforms, including the one you're listening to this show on now. Subscribe, rate, and review, and tell all your friends. We really appreciate you spreading the word about our show. Let's close the program with a longer listen to Good Thing from Abby Hamilton's new album, The Number One Zookeeper of the San Diego Zoo. Enjoy it, and thank you as always for listening to Stereo Embers, the podcast, only right here on Bombshell Radio.
You're due for a good thing, baby. Don't let all that extra weight get you down. Open those blue eyes, take a second. It's fresh rain on the mountain, the birds are singing.